Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, our mission is to unpack the life of one of the most explosive and genuinely transformative figures of the 20th century, Malcolm X. We're not just looking at a biography here, but at an identity mosaic, a life that changed names, religions, and philosophies at a speed that it's hard to find a parallel.
It's an incredible challenge. I mean, you're talking about a life packed into just 39 years, a life that went from utter poverty and crime to becoming a revolutionary and then finally a global human rights advocate. The real story here is the sheer velocity of his evolution.
The names themselves, they really tell the whole story, don't they?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
You start with Malcolm Little. That's just his given name.
Right.
But then he becomes Malcolm X.
Yeah.
And that's a powerful symbolic rejection of the, the slave master's name.
And it doesn't even stop there.
Not at all. After his pilgrimage, his Hajj, he becomes El Hajj Malik El Shabazz. It's a total spiritual and political rebirth. But the sources point to one name that he treasured, one that maybe captures his final vision best.
Omowale.
Omowale. It's Yoruba, given to him by Nigerian students, and it means the son who has come home. And that really speaks to his final global Pan-African vision.
It's amazing. And for all that complexity, he was, of course, a giant of the civil rights era. For 12 years, from 1952 to 1964, he was the voice of the Nation of Olives.
The undeniable voice. I mean, he was the public face of the NOI. You could argue he built it into what it became.
He absolutely did. And then when he leaves, he doesn't slow down for a second. He immediately creates this dual structure for his work.
Yeah, that's right. He founded the Muslim Mosque, Inc., the MMI, for his religious followers under, Orthodox Sunni Islam. And then for the political side, he creates the Organization of Afro-American Unity, the OAAU.
So it's this incredibly strategic move. It allows him to shift from what had become a pretty rigid religious movement into a much broader, secular, global political strategy just overnight.
But to really understand where that fire, that drive came from, you can't start in Harlem or in prison. You have to go back to his childhood in the Midwest.
Right. Back to Omaha, Nebraska. Born May 19th, 1925, he was the fourth of seven children to Earl and Louise Little. And this family, from day one, was political.
Deeply political. I mean, his parents, Earl and Louise, were devoted followers of Marcus Garvey.
And Earl wasn't just some casual supporter, was he?
No, not at all. He was a local leader for the Universal Negro Improvement Association, the UNIA. And his mother, Louise, was just as involved. She was a secretary and a branch reporter for the UNIA's newspaper, The Negro World.
So this wasn't just a casual political interest. This was the family's core belief system.
It was their ethos. Garveyism was baked into Malcolm's childhood. The ideas of self-reliance, of black pride, of economic independence without needing any kind of white validation. That was the bedrock of his youth.
But holding those beliefs in the 1920s came at an immediate and very high price.
A terrible price.
Yeah.
The family was constantly on the run from white violence. They had to leave Omaha, then Milwaukee, then they settled in Lansing, Michigan, all because of direct threats from the Ku Klux Klan.
And in Lansing, the harassment just continued.
It got worse. They were targeted by the Black Legion, another one of these vicious, white, racist groups. And the threats became reality in 1929, when their family home was burned to the ground. Earl accused the Legion of setting the fire. So for young Malcolm, racism wasn't an abstract idea. It was literal warfare against his family.
And the defining trauma of his childhood, of course, was his father's death. Earl died when Malcolm was just 6 years old. And the official story was that it was a streetcar accident.
Officially, yes. Mm. But you have to understand, Louise Little and the entire Black community there were convinced that he was murdered by white racists. And that gap, between the official story and the community's lived truth, that's a critical moment for him.
It cemented a lifelong distrust of the system, didn't it?
It had to. Malcolm himself went back and forth on it his whole life, sometimes accepting the accident, sometimes claiming it was murder. But that fundamental doubt, that deep suspicion of the white world's institutions, that never left him.
And the system just kept failing them. After Earl's death, the family's financial support just evaporated.
It was devastating. Louise got a very small life insurance payout, but the larger policy refused to pay. They claimed his death was a suicide, not an accident or murder.
So the system not only fails to deliver justice, but it uses its own ruling to financially ruin the survivors.
Precisely. Think about the message that sends to a child. Louise tried everything. Farming, renting out parts of the garden, her sons were out hunting for food. But the weight of the violence, the poverty, the constant instability, it was just too much.
And it led to her nervous breakdown in 1938. She was committed to a state hospital.
and the children were all separated, sent to different foster homes. But here's a detail that really speaks to the man he would become. He and his siblings never gave up on her. It took them 24 years, but they eventually secured her release.
It's just, you can't understand the Malcolm X of the 1960s without understanding that his family was systematically destroyed piece by piece long before he ever committed a crime.
Exactly. And that feeling of being totally failed by the system, that set the stage for this pivotal moment in 1941 that pushed him away from education for good.
This wasn't just a kid dropping out of school.
No. This was a formative act of racial disillusionment.
Yeah.
He was doing really well in junior high. He was one of the top students. He told a white teacher he trusted, Mr. Ostrowski, that he wanted to be a lawyer.
And the teacher's response?
The teacher told him that being a lawyer was no realistic goal for a nigger.
Wow.
And that one comment just shattered his ambition. It confirmed everything he had already experienced. That no matter how smart you are, no matter how hard you work, the white world offered no place for a career-oriented black man. So he left school. He was done.
He heads for the city, first to Roxbury in Boston to live with his half-sister Ella, and then in 1943 to Harlem. And he basically decides that if the system won't let him succeed legally, he'll do it illegally.
And that's where the identity of Detroit Red is born.
Right.
He had jobs. Sure, he worked on the railroad. Mm. But his real energy, his real ambition went into the hustle. We're talking drug dealing, gambling, racketeering, robbery, pimping. Get the name Detroit Red because of his reddish hair.
And it's a fascinating side note that one of his close friends in that world was another Red.
Yeah, John Elroy Sanford, who they called Chicago Red. He would later become, of all people, the legendary comedian Red Fox. It just paints a picture of that underground world.
We also see his calculated defiance during this time with how he handled the World War II draft.
Oh, that was pure performance art.
Yeah.
He wanted out of the military, but he also wanted to express his absolute contempt for the government. So when he went for his interview, he acted mentally unstable. He said outrageous things.
He told them he wanted to go south and organize black soldiers.
He did. He said, I want to be sent down south. Organize them nigger soldiers, steal us some guns, and kill us some crackers. He was immediately declared mentally unfit for service. It was a brilliant strategic move to defy the system.
But that life couldn't last. He went back to Boston, got involved in a string of burglaries, and in 1946, he was arrested. He got a harsh sentence, 8 to 10 years in prison.
And that arrest is the hard stop. It's the end of Detroit Red, and it's the beginning of Malcolm X's intellectual awakening.
Mm.
But before we get to that, we do have to touch on a really contentious historical claim from this period.
The allegations of bisexuality.
Right. This comes mainly from the work of historian Manning Marable. It adds this layer of complexity to a man who would later champion a very, very strict moral code.
So what exactly did Marable claim?
Marable argued that Malcolm kind of exaggerated parts of his criminal life for the autobiography. But the main claim was that he had an early homosexual relationship with a white businessman for money.
It's framed as something transactional, not about his orientation.
Exactly, what some would call straight trade.
Yeah.
But it's a very specific claim, and it's not based on, you know, Malcolm's own words. It's historical interpretation.
And his family has pushed back on this hard.
Fiercely. His daughter, Ilyasa Shavaz, has been very clear. She argues that her father was brutally honest about his past in the autobiography. I mean, he included all sorts of embarrassing details. Her point is, if he had a gay encounter, he likely would have talked about it.
So for them, it feels like an attempt to sensationalize that period of his life.
That seems to be their view. But regardless of that specific debate, the man who walked into prison in 1946 was not the man who walked out. And that brings us to the Nation of Islam, his conversion, his incredible rise, and the core beliefs that would define him for more than a decade.
Prison for him wasn't an end. It was, in his own words, a kind of freedom.
It's amazing, isn't it? He wrote that being in prison gave him a freedom he'd never known on the streets. He said, I had never been so truly free in my life. He would get so lost in reading that he'd forget he was even locked up.
And that fire for learning, it was lit by another inmate, right?
By a man named John Bembry. Bembry was self-educated, and Malcolm was just in awe of how he could command respect just with his words, with his vocabulary. And Malcolm saw that and realized that's real power. It's not in a gun. It's in the mind.
So that's what sparked his famous project to educate himself.
That was the turning point. He started by literally copying the entire dictionary word for word onto a tablet just to absorb the language. He took all that energy he'd put into hustling and channeled it with incredible discipline into mastering his own mind.
The actual conversion to the Nation of Islam, though, that came through his family.
It did. It was a letter from his brother Reginald in 1948, and the instruction was so simple.
Don't eat any more pork, and don't smoke any more cigarettes.
I'll show you how to get out of prison. And Malcolm did it instantly. It was this immediate act of discipline. At first, he was skeptical of the core NOI teaching, you know, the idea that white people were literally devils.
But his own life experiences made him receptive to it.
They did. He thought about all the white people who had betrayed him or hurt his family, and he already hated Christianity. They called him Satan, imprisoned because of it. So he was ready for a completely new way of seeing the world.
And by 1950, he's writing back and forth with the leader of the Nation of Islam, Elijah Muhammad.
Yes, and Muhammad tells him to renounce his past, to pray, to submit. And this is when he makes that huge symbolic break. This is when he becomes Malcolm X.
The X symbolizing the lost African name.
Exactly. Muhammad taught that their family names were slave names imposed by their masters. The X was to represent the true ancestral name they could never know. Malcolm was very clear. His X replaced the white slave master name of Little.
It's just incredible that in the exact same year he's having this profound internal transformation, the U.S. government starts a file on him.
It's so significant. The FBI opened their file in 1950, and this is before he's anybody. It was just because he wrote a letter to President Truman opposing the Korean War and calling himself a communist. It shows you they were watching from the very, very beginning.
So he's paroled in 1952, and his rise within the NOI is just meteoric.
He was a phenomenon. He goes from being an assistant minister in Detroit to starting new temples in Boston and Philadelphia. By 1954, he's leading Temple No. 7 in Harlem, which was the most important mosque in the country.
And his charisma was a huge part of it.
A huge part. He was this incredibly commanding figure. 6'3", always perfectly dressed, an absolutely electrifying speaker. He radiated discipline and power.
And the numbers speak for themselves. He's credited with the NOI's explosive growth in this period.
It was exponential. The estimates say the membership went from maybe 1,200 people when he joined to somewhere between 50 and 100,000 by the early 60s. He brought in huge figures like Muhammad Ali. He was a star maker.
And that power he had, it was put on stunning public display in 1957 during the Hinton-Johnson incident.
Ah, yes. This is the moment that really put him on the map for the authorities. Hinton Johnson, an NOI member, was brutally beaten by the NYPD. Malcolm X gets the call, he goes down to the police station, and by the time he gets there, a huge, angry crowd of thousands has gathered outside.
Ready to explode.
Absolutely.
But
he handles it with this chilling level of control.
Mm-hmm.
He goes inside, negotiates to get Johnson to a hospital. Then he comes back out, faces this massive, seething crowd, and just raises one hand.
And what happens?
The Nation of Islam members, the Fruit of Islam, they turn and walk away. Silently, in perfect formation. And then the rest of the crowd just sort of dissolves. They follow their lead.
And the police reaction to that silent display of power is the real story.
It is. A police officer was overheard saying, "No one man should have that much power." And that wasn't just an observation. That was a threat assessment. Within a month, the NYPD had undercover officers infiltrating the Nation of Islam, specifically targeting Malcolm X.
So let's talk about the ideology he was preaching at this time. It was radical. It was separatist. It was a direct inversion of white supremacy.
That's a perfect way to put it.
Yeah.
The core teaching was that black people were the original people of the earth. And the counter-narrative was the story of Yaqub, an evil black scientist who, thousands of years ago, created the white race, a race of devils whose time on earth was now coming to an end.
And he justified using that explosive language by pointing directly to history.
He did. He said, you just have to look at the historical record.
Yeah.
He would list the actions of European colonialism. Anybody who rapes and plunders and enslaves and steals and drops hell bombs on people is nothing but a devil. For his audience, this was incredibly powerful.
The NOI also presented a completely new theology.
A total rejection of Christianity. They called it the white man's religion, something imposed on slaves to keep them docile. Instead, they taught that the founder, Wallace Fard Muhammad, was God in person, and that Elijah Muhammad was his chosen messenger or prophet.
And this put him on a direct collision course with the mainstream civil rights movement and Martin Luther King Jr.
Their goals were polar opposites. Malcolm X rejected integration completely. He wanted a separate black nation carved out of the United States, and he demanded reparations for slavery.
He called leaders like King Chumps and Stooges.
He did. He felt they were begging the white establishment for rights that were already theirs. and he completely rejected nonviolence. He argued that Black people had every right to defend themselves by any means necessary.
Which is why he had such contempt for the 1963 March on Washington.
He dismissed it entirely. He called it the farce on Washington. He saw it as a feel-good spectacle that had been co-opted and controlled by white liberals. He famously asked why Black people were celebrating in front of a statue of Lincoln, a president who didn't like us when he was alive.
That brings us to the breaking point, the disillusionment, the departure, and the incredible global transformation of his final year.
And this all starts with betrayal. His absolute faith in Elijah Muhammad was completely shattered by two events that exposed a deep, deep hypocrisy at the heart of the Nation of Islam.
The first was the Ronald Stokes killing in Los Angeles in 1962.
A brutal incident. LAPD officers beat and shot several unarmed Muslims outside their mosque. A Korean War vet named Ronald Stokes was shot in the back and killed while he had his hands up. Another man was paralyzed for life.
And Malcolm demanded action.
He was furious. He wanted to retaliate, or at least organize, a massive political response. He was ready to go to war for them. But Elijah Muhammad shut him down. He forbade any action at all.
Why?
It stunned Malcolm. He realized Muhammad cared more about protecting the organization's money and stability than he did about getting justice for a murdered follower. That was the first major crack in his faith.
But the final fatal blow was discovering Elijah Muhammad's sexual misconduct.
This was the crisis of conscience he couldn't overcome. Rumors were spreading that Muhammad was having affairs with his young secretaries, which was a grave violation of the NOI's strict moral code.
He didn't want to believe it at first.
No, he was completely loyal. But he investigated. He talked to the young women involved. And then he confronted Elijah Muhammad himself, who admitted it was true. He even tried to justify it by citing the polygamy of prophets in the Bible.
And Malcolm's investigation uncovered something even darker than just affairs.
That's right. He later testified publicly that his investigation confirmed multiple counts of child rape and that several of the girls became pregnant. This wasn't just hypocrisy. This was profound corruption by the man he viewed as a divine messenger.
And when he tried to expose this, the organization turned on him.
Immediately, he started getting death threats. They found a bomb in his car. The very machine he helped build was now trying to kill him.
And all this is boiling under the surface when he makes his infamous comment about the Kennedy assassination.
Right. In December 1963, he says JFK's murder was a case of chickens coming home to roost, meaning the violence the U.S. government exported was now coming back to haunt it.
The public outrage was immense, and the NOI used it as their opportunity.
It was the perfect excuse for Elijah Muhammad to silence him. The NOI publicly censured him and banned him from speaking for 90 days. It was a way to push him out, and Malcolm knew it.
So on March 8, 1964, he makes it official. He leaves the Nation of Islam.
He does. He announces that the organization has gone as far as it can, that it's too rigid, and he immediately says he's forming a new Black nationalist organization, and in a huge shift, that he's now willing to work with other civil rights leaders. He was free.
And that year of freedom was one of the most intense periods of growth for any public figure in history. It starts with his famous The Ballot or the Bullet speech.
That speech laid out his new strategy. Use the vote, he said, but if the government keeps denying you your rights, then you may have to use the bullet. It was a pragmatic warning, and he framed it under a flexible Black nationalism that could, you know, work with other groups on specific goals.
In the middle of all this, he has that one brief meeting with Martin Luther King Jr.
Just a fleeting moment. They met at the U.S. Capitol, just long enough for that iconic photograph. But it's telling that King later said he had deep affection for Malcolm, and that Malcolm had this incredible ability to diagnose the root of the problem.
But the truly life-altering event was his pilgrimage to Mecca in April 1964. The Hajj. This is what transforms Malcolm X into El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz.
This was the experience that she just demolished the NOI's racial theology for him. He wrote back in these amazing letters about seeing Muslims of all colors, from blue-eyed blondes to black-skinned Africans, all praying together as equals.
And that forced him to completely reevaluate his entire worldview on race.
Completely. He said he had to toss aside his previous conclusions about all white people being devils. He converted to Orthodox Sunni Islam and immediately set up his new organizations, the religious MMI and the secular OAAU.
And he used the OAAU to make a brilliant strategic move, reframing the civil rights struggle as a human rights struggle.
This was revolutionary. By doing that, he was arguing that the U.S. treatment of its Black citizens was a violation of international law. It meant he could take the United States before the UN, before the World Court. It was a way to bypass the American system entirely and shame it on a global stage.
Which is why he started those extensive tours of Africa and the Middle East.
Exactly. He is connecting the struggle at home to the anti-colonial struggles all over the Third World. And he was welcomed like a head of state. Leaders like Nkrumah in Ghana, Nasser in Egypt, they all met with him. Some even offered him positions in their governments.
He used that platform to go after Western imperialism, especially in the Congo.
He was furious about the situation in the Congo. He called the Western-backed leader, Moise Tshombe, the worst African ever born, for hiring white mercenaries to kill his own people. And he accused President Johnson and the U.S. of propping up this murderous regime.
He also called out the media bias and how the conflict was being covered.
A blatant double standard. He pointed out how the Western press obsessed over atrocities committed by African rebels against white missionaries, but completely ignored the war crimes being committed by the white mercenaries and CIA-backed pilots. It was only an emergency when white lives were at stake.
And all of this global exposure forced him to reconsider his old hardline stance on race and integration.
It did. In his last year, he started speaking with regret about how rigid he'd been. He told a story about turning away a young white college girl who wanted to help. He said his time in the NOI was like being a zombie, like he was hypnotized. He realized racism was a global problem, not just a black and white American one.
His travels also took him to Gaza, where he engaged with the Palestinian cause.
Yes, he met with the PLO and visited a refugee camp. He wrote an essay called Zionist Logic, where he argued that the occupation of Palestine had no intelligent or legal basis in history, and called Zionism another form of European imperialism designed to divide the Arab world.
And finally, he even opened the door to socialism.
He did. After criticizing capitalism, he was asked if he was a socialist, and his answer was purely pragmatic. He said, "If socialism is good for black people, then I'm for it." It shows how far he'd come from a rigid theology to a flexible, results-oriented political strategy.
Which brings us, tragically, to the end. The assassination, the conspiracy, and his legacy. The moment he left the NOI, the threats became constant and very, very real.
The escalation was terrifying. Just a month after he left, someone was ordered to bomb his car. The NOI's own newspaper, Muhammad Speaks, was publishing what were basically open calls for his death.
The rhetoric from people like Louis X, who had been his protege, was chilling.
Elijah Muhammad himself told Louis X that hypocrites like Malcolm should have their heads cut off. And then they published that horrific cartoon showing Malcolm's severed head bouncing down the street. It was a public death sentence.
And a week before his death, his house was firebombed.
On February 14, 1965, he and his family barely escaped. He was certain it was the Nation of Islam. It's why that famous photo of him holding a rifle at his window is so powerful. He was a man under siege, defending his family.
And 7 days later, on February 21st, 1965, at the Audubon Ballroom, it happened.
He was just about to start his speech. A fight was staged in the audience to create a distraction. As Malcolm's security moved toward it, a man rushed the stage with a sawed-off shotgun and fired into his chest. Two other men then opened fire with handguns.
He was hit 21 times. He was 39 years old.
The crowd managed to catch one of the gunmen, an NOI member named Talmadge Hayer, or Thomas Hagen. He and two other NOI members were eventually convicted, but that was never the whole story.
No, this is where the conspiracy theories begin, and many of them have turned out to be true.
For decades, Hayer, the one shooter who was caught at the scene, always confessed to his role. But he also always insisted that the other two men convicted with him, Butler and Johnson, were innocent.
He named other people.
He did. He named four other members from the Newark Mosque as the real accomplices. But for decades, nobody listened.
Until 2021, when the two men were finally exonerated.
Finally. A review found that the FBI and the NYPD had withheld crucial evidence at the original trial. Evidence that proved their innocence. So you have two men who spent decades in prison for a murder they did not commit.
Which has led to these massive lawsuits against the government.
Absolutely. The family filed a $100 million wrongful death suit against the CIA, the FBI, and the NYPD, alleging that they were not just negligent, but were actively involved in the conspiracy to have him killed.
So who do these theories point to?
Well, there's a lot of focus on John Ali, a top NOI official, who was widely suspected of being an FBI informant. He apparently met with the shooter the night before the assassination. And then there's Louis Farrakhan, who has admitted that his fiery rhetoric at the time may have been complicit in creating the atmosphere that led to the murder.
The reaction to his death was just as polarized as his life had been.
It really was. In America, the mainstream press was brutal. The New York Times called him a twisted man whose life was pitifully wasted.
But internationally, it was a different story.
Completely. Oh. Across Africa and the Third World, he was mourned as a revolutionary martyr, killed by American racists. And at his funeral, the actor Ossie Davis gave that beautiful eulogy, calling him our shining black prince.
Even Martin Luther King Jr., his great rival, expressed a profound sense of loss.
He did. He called his murder a tragedy and acknowledged Malcolm's unique power to diagnose the core of America's racial sickness.
And today, his legacy is just. It's immense. He's seen as one of the most influential African Americans in history.
Undeniably. He's largely responsible for the spread of Islam in the black community. His philosophy directly inspired the Black Power movement, the Black Arts movement, the whole idea that black is beautiful.
And so much of that legacy is preserved in his autobiography.
The autobiography of Malcolm X is a monumental book. And he knew he wouldn't live to see it published. He told Alex Haley, "If I'm alive when this book comes out, it will be a miracle." It's one of the most important nonfiction books of the century.
His life continues to inspire art and culture, from the X-Men's Magneto to characters in movies like Black Panther.
It's an archetype now, the revolutionary who speaks truth to power. He's been formally recognized with street names, holidays, and just recently, induction into the Nebraska Hall of Fame.
So when you look at the whole arc, from Malcolm Little's shattered childhood to Detroit Red's criminal life to Malcolm X's radical ministry and finally to El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz's global humanism, it's just a stunning story of evolution, a story about the cost of intellectual freedom and the relentless pursuit of truth.
And it leaves us with this profound question. Think about his final year. He was simultaneously trying to take on the entire U.S. government by bringing it before the World Court for human rights violations.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, he was trying to expose the deep criminal corruption inside the Nation of Islam.
Two incredibly dangerous fronts.
The most dangerous. So what does it tell you about the nature of power when you have to challenge both the state and the church, so to speak? He proved that challenging a sacred internal power structure could be just as deadly as challenging the massive external one. He died because he refused to stay quiet, pursuing justice by any means necessary.
And as a final thought for you, we've looked at these four distinct identities: the hustler, the NOI minister, the global pilgrim, and the martyr. We'll leave you to think about which of those four identities has had the most profound and lasting impact on the idea of black identity and political self-determination, both in America and around the world today.
Thank you for joining us for the deep dive.
We'll see you next time.